All right, our topic tonight is the 1996 election in Israel. We left off last time in October of 1995 with the passage in the Knesset by a razor-thin margin of the Oslo II agreements, which gave control over the major West Bank cities to the PLO. And that it passed by a vote of 61 to 59, possibly with an element of bribery from members of the former members of the Tzomet Party who crossed over to the left camp, and certain members of the left camp who crossed over to the right camp to become the Third Way. So it was a tough time in Israel, and nasty words were flying back and forth, especially the invective that was being thrown at Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister, by elements within the national religious community and the right wing more generally. And then, on the night of November 4th, 1995, Yigal Amir assassinates Yitzhak Rabin at Kikar Malchei Yisrael, which now is Kikar Yitzhak Rabin, and Shimon Peres takes over. So what is the political ramification of the assassination of a prime minister by a fellow Israeli Jew? Well, the answer is that everybody rallied around the Labor Party. There was the sympathy factor, that the cause, the worthy cause of peace, was almost gunned down by a madman, but we're not going to let the cause of peace be destroyed. Yitzhak took one for the team, he lost his life, but the cause will continue. And so, Shimon Peres, now the interim prime minister, gets a bump in the polls. He's doing quite well. And the big question is, when to call for a new election? Because in Israel, a parliamentary system, you're supposed to have one every 4 years, but you could have them sooner if there is a need for it. And arguably, from the standpoint of the Labor Party and Shimon Peres personally, you want to have a mandate, a fresh mandate for your activities going forward, which can be achieved by a successful electoral outcome. And you want to have it in your own name, not as the afterthought to Yitzhak Rabin's term. Shimon wants to win an election for himself. Plus, to win an election means people have to want to vote for you. And historically, people haven't always wanted to vote for Shimon Peres. But the sympathy factor in the aftermath of the Rabin assassination means that maybe people who otherwise wouldn't have voted for him will do so. With that in mind, when should he call for an election? You could argue immediately, as soon as possible. But he didn't do that. Why not?
Wouldn't you think the body's not warm? It's still warm?
The body's a little warm, okay? And there would be those who would perceive a too hastily called election as being taking advantage of someone else's death for your own personal political gain. So too soon, can't do it. But when? The term ends in December or November of 1996. Ultimately, they settle upon late May, May 29th, 1996, the 11th of Sivan. And we're going to see that comes back to hurt Shimon Peres. The timing was ill-advised. He should have made a different decision. Is he likely to win? Everybody thinks he's going to win. Like Hillary Clinton. Everybody thought she was going to win, okay? And we're going to see there are comparisons to Bibi and Trump in 1996. I'll explain what those are also. Everyone thinks that Shimon Peres is going to win. All the media, the intellectual elite, are all in his favor. And they think that it's going to be a runaway. Who else supports Peres' candidacy? Well, the myth is that Bill Clinton vigorously campaigned for Shimon Peres and interfered in the internal workings of an Israeli election. That's actually not true at all. Really, the American president just continued to behave along the lines that the American president and administration would have behaved irrespective of election or no election in Israel. And that is to be actively supportive of the Oslo process and doing everything to make sure that it is not scuttled by some act of violence one side against the other, regardless of which side. That may be looked upon as vigorous support for Shimon Peres, but really it was not. there was no true interference in the nefarious sense of the word. Which other world figures supported Peres? Well, almost all of them. Most of the Arab leaders, Yasser Arafat certainly, the European leaders, but one Arab leader in particular favored the Likud candidate Benjamin Netanyahu. And who was that? And for not necessarily an obvious reason, but who was it? King Hussein. King Hussein actually, behind the scenes, did a few things in Bibi's favor. And the reason is because, although King Hussein would like to see a political accommodation between Israel and the PLO and a resolution to the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Hashemite kingdom had long believed that they are the rightful protectors and rulers over what? Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Dome of the Rock. And there was a fear that Peres would divide Jerusalem, or that the Labor Party was moving very, very far to the left by Israeli standards, including making compromises on Jerusalem with the PLO, as opposed to retaining Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem but granting religious authority over the Temple Mount to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, which, by the way, is what ultimately happened. The Jordanians still have a certain measure of authority on the Temple Mount at Yom HaZeh. Yeah. Yeah.
And that is the majority Palestinian population that may one day overthrow the...
Well, they've had that problem from day one, and for 73 years they've avoided the collapse of their kingdom, although they, Abdullah the First took a bullet in the head because of it. Yet the kingdom survives. We'll see what happens going forward. So that he was the one Arab leader who favored Netanyahu ever so slightly. So the thinking is that Labor is going to win, and yet they don't. What happens? There's an election. There are two elections. There's the direct election of the prime minister for the first time in Israel's history, and there's a Knesset election for the 14th Knesset. So people vote two times on the same day, right in quick succession. One slip of paper, another slip of paper. And the outcome is that Benjamin Netanyahu wins 50.1% of the vote. Shimon Peres wins 49.9% of the vote. 30,000 vote difference. Bibi wins by a small majority. In the Knesset election, Labor wins 34 seats. Likud wins 32. The other parties we'll talk about soon enough. So although Likud finishes second, it doesn't matter, because the direct election of prime minister means that that man forms the government, even though he doesn't have a plurality in the parliament. That makes forming a coalition maybe a little bit more difficult, but it turns out to be doable, and Bibi assembles a coalition of 66 members, which ones we'll see soon. Okay, how does this happen? How does Labor lose? How does the Likud win? Let's start with Labor losing first. So first of all, Labor overemphasized the assassination of Rabin and accused the entire right side of the aisle, especially the religious Zionist rabbis, of being guilty and having blood on their hands. That's a really nasty thing to say. I mean, one man committed an act of murder, and you're going to tar and feather half the population of the country? Or all the people who wear knitted yarmulkes? It's not nice.
Well, the press said some of the religious rabbis...
So granted, there were rabbis whose names I'm not going to mention here, but you could look it up on Wikipedia, who said all sorts of horrible things, that Rabin was a rodef, that he was a mamzer, that he was a malek. All the nasty terms, the Talmudic terms we say about bad Jews, were said by some of the religious Zionist rabbis about Yitzhak Rabin before he was shot. That is undeniable. But to say that the whole community of the Dati Lumi have blood on their hands because of one man's action, that's not very nice. And the political consequences of making that accusation are that people think you've overreached, and there's a backlash. And the backlash is, I'm not going to vote for Labor, or I'm not going to vote for Shimon Peres if he's speaking ill of everybody who wears a knitted yarmulke. I'm going to vote for Bibi. Whether I like him or not, I'm not going to vote for Shimon Peres, who besmirched everyone's integrity.
That was just an excuse, that they were going to vote against him no matter what.
Okay, so granted, many people would fall into the camp that you're talking about. But there are people in the swing vote category, the floating vote, who are offended by the nasty rhetoric in the post-assassination period. By the way, the person who was most egregious here was Leah Rabin herself, who said that Bibi Netanyahu is complicit in the murder of my husband. That finished her. I mean, a lot of people didn't like her to begin with, and even more people didn't like her after that. So yes, people feel bad that she lost her husband, but she went over the top in accusing people of things. That's point number one. They didn't like the blame game. Point number two is, as I began to say a few moments ago, the elections were both too early and too late. Like the porridge, it can't be too hot and too cold. Had the elections happened when the body was still warm, Peres held a 30-point lead in the polls. He would have benefited from the emotions that were in the air in Israel in November and December of 95. But the anti-labor backlash by centrists and right-wing voters who didn't like the fact that Labor and Leah Rabin and Shimon Peres were accusing everybody on the right side of the aisle of murder, that kicked in by February, March, and April. And that's going to hurt somebody on the left side of the aisle, like Peres, if the election is held in May, which it was. Had the election been had it not been pushed forward, had it been held at the appropriate time in late 1996, the whole topic of Rabin's death and the anti-labor backlash after the pro-labor sympathy would have all been over and done with, and probably Labor would have won. So he chose a bad time. May was neither here nor there. It was too early and it was too late simultaneously. Point number three, Labor tried to turn to the center because, after all, the floating vote is in the center, or at least it was in the mid-1990s. But they couldn't turn to the center. Why not? After 4 years of governing from the far left, nobody's going to believe you if you try to turn to the center. It's one thing if you're not the incumbent and you don't have a track record. You could say whatever you want. You could espouse any position, and whether you live up to it or not is your business once you get elected. But when you are the incumbent and you've been governing for 4 years in a way that was moving further and further to the left on matters of war and peace as the years went by, how can you all of a sudden jump to a centrist position? Nobody's falling for it. Most significantly on this front, matters of defense and religion merged into Jewishness. And Bibi won the more Jewish you were. Who lives in Israel? There are five kinds of Israeli citizens. We'll give them numbers, 1 through 5. Number 1 are the non-Jews. Number 2 are the secular Jews. Number 3 are the traditional Jews. Number 4 are the religious Zionist Jews. And number 5 are the ultra-Orthodox Jews. The further you are to number 5, the more likely you were to vote for Bibi. The further you were to number 1, the more likely you were to vote for Peres. And in this election, the Jewishness of the state was considered to be in play, and it was tied together with matters of war and peace and land and giving up of land, more so than ever before.
But you look at these as equal groups.
They're not equal groups. They're not equal groups. The middle group, the number 3 group, is the most important, the so-called traditional group. I'd say that's about 50% of the population, with secular being maybe 15%, the Arabs being about 10%. Yeah. So, next point, fourth point. Labor was closely associated with Meretz's anti-Judaism. Meretz was the only party to run a nasty campaign, to go below the belt. There was very little below the belt campaigning in this go-around, in part because Peres and Netanyahu historically didn't hate each other. In fact, the Netanyahu family, since Yoni's death in 1976, always had a soft spot in their heart for Shimon Peres, who, as the defense minister, gave a nice eulogy at the funeral. There was no real personal venom one against the other. They were not on the same wavelength politically, but they didn't hate each other. So the below-the-belt stuff was really reserved for Meretz. Meretz ran an anti-Jewish campaign. You could argue an anti-Semitic campaign. I mean, it was nasty. And Labor's left flank was closely associated with Meretz. Yael Dayan, Avraham Berg, and Dalia Itzik were seen as the Haredi bashers among labor. And they certainly were. And Yael Dayan was closely associated with the homosexual community in Israel, which in 1996 is not the same thing as 2019. To be closely aligned with the gay community 23 years ago in a socially conservative place like Israel is not going to win you too many friends. So this anti-Judaism was hurting labor. As a result, the Jewish Jews, they vote for Bibi. Bibi was the Jewish candidate, just like Trump was the Christian candidate in 2016. Meaning, even though both of them were twice divorced and had marital affairs and all sorts of mishigasin in their personal life, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because they're in the correct camp, and the other side is anti your so-called religious values. So therefore, if you want to preserve religious values, you vote for Bibi despite the fact that he is a philanderer. Okay.
Abortion
wasn't much of an issue in 1996 in Israel. It had been an issue in earlier election cycles with Shmuel Tamir, when he tried to relax the abortion laws and got himself kicked out of the Likud party. That's not for tonight's session. Of course it should be. What position you want to take is up for debate. But yes, Judaism has what to say on it. Now, number five. And this is the one that people remember. Why did labor lose? Because of terrorism. Because on February 25th, 1996, there were twin bus bombings in Jerusalem and in Ashkelon Junction. And then a week later, in early March, there were again bombings in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv. And these were very bloody. By the standards of the Second Intifada, they might not have been the bloodiest. But by the standards of the Oslo period, they were as bad as it gets. Okay? And the fact that there was terrorism on the heels of recent territorial concessions meant that the peace process wasn't producing peace. And so Shimon Peres could not claim, you have greater personal security because of my diplomatic overtures to the Palestinians. In fact, your personal security is much worse than it had been before the peace process began. Okay. Well, Peres needed to seem strong. He had to do something to seem strong. Remember in 1992 when Rabin wanted to seem strong, what did he do? He kicked out 415 members of Hamas and shipped them off to Lebanon on buses. Remember that? So that's what he did. What did Peres do? Well, again, Lebanon. Operation Grapes of Wrath, like the book. Okay? Operation Grapes of Wrath was an action against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon because the Katyusha rockets were flying. And this was a way to show, I am Mr. Security and not a weakling. The problem with Operation Grapes of Wrath is that it quickly unraveled with an attack on Kfar Kana, where over 100 civilians, refugees, were killed in an errant bombing. That operation came back in the news not that long ago because Naftali Bennett was a low-ranking officer at the time involved in that incident and is blamed by some for what went wrong. It's probably unfair. It's probably besmirching his military record. I don't know. I wasn't there. But it came back in the news 20 years later. So this was a big problem, Operation Grapes of Wrath. When you kill 100 innocent Arabs, and you're the leader of the Labour Party, and you want to win an election, how does that hurt your chances? Who do you expect to vote for you? Arabs. And now Arabs are Bregis with Shimon Peres. So what are they going to do about it? They're going to vote for Bibi? No. What are they going to do? Stay home. Don't vote. Or not stay home. Remember, it's a dual ballot. So they'll vote for the communists, so they'll vote for the Balad or the Ramtal, the Palestinian National, but they won't vote for Prime Minister. It'll be a blank ballot. And that will be very costly to the candidate of the left, Shimon Peres. Okay. Number six, polls don't tell the true story. And when polls don't tell the true story, but people think that they do, then if you're the one who the polls say is winning, you become overconfident. And in your overconfidence, what do? You neglect to run for office. You pull a Joe Crowley or something and you forget to run and you lose. Number seven, Meretz accused Peres of not telling the electorate the whole truth about the extent of the peace process. Meaning, and this is very, very important because it's 100% true. Remember in 1992, Rabin said he wouldn't talk to the PLO? And then what happened in 1993? Rabin talked to the PLO. So Israel was moving further and further to the left from the late 80s through the year 2000. So that by the year 2000, 2001, a guy like Ehud Barak could give away the store, including half of Jerusalem, and only Arafat saying no prevented it from happening. But all that was an impossibility by the standards of the mid to late 80s, even for a Labour Party candidate. So the goalposts were moved very, very far to the left. And yet, the leading candidates, the prime ministerial candidates, didn't always acknowledge that openly. They had to run on a more centrist platform because they wanted to win election. And the public at large isn't ready for these kinds of concessions, at least not on election night. So Meretz is saying, we know what you really think, but you're not telling it like it is. We, Meretz, are saying like it is. We're open and honest about how we want a Palestinian state, and we want to give away the store, but you're not saying it, even though you really want to do it. Now, Peres, of course, would deny all this, but who did believe it? Who did believe that what Meretz was saying about how Labor was concealing the truth? The answer is plenty of the voters. And if the voters think that Meretz is telling the truth, but they completely disagree with Meretz's position, what's going to happen? They're going to vote for Benjamin Netanyahu and right-of-center parties because they don't want to be bamboozled by a lying Shimon Peres, who, by the way, was always accused of not being so forthright. Okay. Number 8. The alliance between the Haredim and Netanyahu worked to perfection because the Haredim really wanted to vote for Bibi. By contrast, the alliance between the Arabs and Shimon Peres was much less efficient because the Arabs didn't really like Peres. It was just a marriage of convenience. Let me clarify this. If I'm an Arab living in Nazareth or Umm al-Fahm, I don't like Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres is a lifelong Zionist who held every major position in the history of the State of Israel, is my adversary, basically, in the 100-year conflict between Jews and Arabs. But I want to vote for him because of the two candidates to run the government, he's more likely to give away the territories to the Arabs than is Netanyahu. So I have to vote for him because he's more aligned with what I want, but I don't like him, and I don't like the Labour Party, what they stand for, more broadly. So when it's a marriage of convenience, and you introduce the issue of Kfar Kana, some people are going to drop off the radar and not vote. As opposed to the religious side of the aisle, the religious Jews, who, yes, Bibi is not necessarily their guy because he's not a religious man himself and he has his own problems in personal life and the like, but they want to vote for him. They want to vote for a right-wing Zionist. Remember, the Haredim are the biggest Zionists. Certainly Chabad is. And to be honest, by the mid-1990s, even the yeshiva crowd, they are no longer anti-nationalist. They may be opposed to the symbols of statehood, the flag, the draft, the IDF. That's removed from their life because of Haredi ideology. But when it comes down to it, they're right-wing nationalists, and they want to vote for a right-wing government. They don't want to give away the store. So,
are they under the control of the Rebbe?
Well, the parties are under the control of the Rebbe in the sense that Rabbi Avadi Yosef controls Shas with an iron fist, and Rav Shach controls Degel HaTorah, which this time around merged again with the Aguda. So he has a very significant say over the Aguda. The NRP is not controlled by the rabbis, they're controlled by the politicians. So the religious, they want to vote for a right-wing candidate. And that's why it's more of an effective alliance than was the Arabs with Peres. And number 9, last one, Labor was on the end of a long institutional decline, meaning for decades, Mapai controlled the state, the pre-state yeshuv, and their institutions, including the kibbutzim and the histadrut, were very strong, and this helped produce electoral results. But by the mid-1990s, all that was basically dead. Histadrut was ceasing to be a relevant factor, the kibbutzim were bankrupt and going private. So you don't have the institutional heft that you once had. Okay. So all this was to explain why Labor lost. Let's now go to the Likud side of things. How did they win? And did they really win? Okay. So Netanyahu was a pragmatist and an example of the Americanization of Israeli politics. He wanted to win, and he would do whatever it took to win the pre-ministerial contest, even if it meant compromising greatly on the parliamentary contest. Now, how does that work? There were many candidates for prime minister. There was Shimon Peres, Benjamin Netanyahu, Ariel Sharon, David Levy, the butt of everyone's joke, and Raful Eitan. So Ariel Sharon, after the assassination of Rabin, dropped out of the race. He understood that a bolvan like him can't win in an environment where somebody just got shot. So, having dropped out of the race, he wants the right side of the aisle to win. And that means it has to be Bibi. But Bibi can only win if the other candidates to the right also drop out. Because if they don't drop out, there's a chance that in a first round of balloting, Shimon Peres will get 40% of the vote. And the halacha was, if you get 40% in the first round, what happens? You win. And there is no second round. So how do you get Raful Eitan and David Levy to drop out of the election? The answer is you bribe them. You bribe them with parliamentary seats. And so Likud made a deal with Eitan that so many candidates will get 7 out of the top 42 on a joint list with Likud. Then David Levy's Gesher got the same deal. They really shouldn't have gotten the same deal because David Levy wasn't going to get 7 seats. But, all right, Bibi had to do what he had to do. So in the end, 14 out of the top 42 seats in the Likud list were given to non-Likudniks. It was now Likud, Gesher, Tzomet. A rainbow coalition. The Likud was upset about this. There were people who had seats in the 13th Knesset who said, you know what, I'm going to be voted out. I don't have a safe seat anymore. Moreover, when it comes to the division of spoils in the cabinet, if we win, you're going to have to give away a whole lot to these other partners. And I'm not going to get a juicy portfolio. So the story was after the election night, that Bibi won and Likud lost. And there's a lot to say about that. Yes, Bibi won the election by a razor-thin majority, and Likud didn't get a plurality, and didn't get very many seats altogether in the Knesset because of their alliances. Now, how did Bibi turn himself into a reputable prime ministerial candidate? Remember, he's 47 years old, has never held a job as a minister in government. What did he do for a living before this? Well, he went to MIT, then he was a marketing director in a furniture company, then Moshe Arons took him under his wings and made him an advisor, then they made him into the ambassador at the UN, then he came back in 1988 and ran for the Knesset for the first time in the 12th Knesset, and they made him deputy foreign minister. And then in 92, when Likud lost, he's just the opposition leader. So he became the opposition leader at the age of 43, having only been the deputy foreign minister. That's not a very thick resume to lead a major party and to hope to become the head of the country. So he has to transform himself from a radical opposition mouthpiece into a statesman. How do you do that? First of all, you say the right things after Rabin is killed. You say all the right things. We're going to mourn, national mourning. You don't try to do any counterattacks. You keep quiet for about 3 months. In February, he finally gets politically active again. The body's cold now. So he could start talking. And what's he saying? Well, he gets advice from Arthur Finkelstein, the American political strategist, who says you need quick slogans, pithy statements that are going to win people over. So, like what? Well, Peres will divide Jerusalem. That'll get everybody excited. Peres is going to divide Jerusalem. Or, Peres is going to make a Palestinian state. Or, Peres is going to give away the Golan Heights. Remember Ha'amim HaGolan? Some people still have the bumper sticker. If you have an old car, you still didn't get rid of the old 96 wagon, Ha'amim HaGolan. Or Chevron Mi'azul Tamid. Those were the slogans in the 1990s. Well, that's all Bibi's doing. To say, if Labor wins, that's what's going to happen. Was he being honest? To an extent, yes. I mean, eventually Peres favored a Palestinian state. Peres did favor concessions on the Golan for the if Hafez al-Assad would have gone along for the ride. And as for dividing Jerusalem, who's to say? But maybe. So you need to have slogans. Those were all anti-labor. What's the positive slogan? The positive slogan is Likud Osim Shalom Batuach, making a secure peace. Osim Shalom Batuach. What does that mean? Not a reckless peace. The argument is that labor is reckless. They're taking dangerous gambits in favor of peace that are not working out. And we will act more judiciously and we'll make concessions where we think appropriate, but only if it's going to get us something in return. Now, what does Bibi say we need to get in return? What does Israel need? Okay, so number one, in the ephemeral, the revoking of the Palestinian charter that called for the destruction of Israel. This was a big deal. It was supposed to have happened ever since 1993 on the handshake on the lawn. The deal was you revoke your charter. You change the language, which is calling for Israel's destruction. And Arafat and the PLO never did it. And labor under Rabin and Peres kind of ignored it and said it didn't really matter. You know, after all, it's not a tangible thing. It's an ephemeral thing. But Bibi made, oh, it's an important thing. It speaks to their real intentions. And one man was trotted out to the forefront, Professor Yehoshua Porat, one of the founding leaders of Meretz. Okay, Meretz, but also an academic expert on the Palestinians, Palestinian culture and political culture. And he said the fact that they didn't change their covenant tells you everything about what they're going to do. So here a Meretz supporter says, I'm going to vote for Bibi because he's taking seriously the intellectual component, the philosophical component of this whole fight between Israel and the Palestinians. And labor is ignoring it. By the way, you know who else supported Bibi despite being a Meretz voter? Mati Ashkenazi. Who's Mati Ashkenazi? Remember 1974? The protests against Moshe Dayan? Mati Ashkenazi was the man who started that protest outside of the government offices, because he was the man who was in charge of Budapest on the Barlev line, and he felt that the government had betrayed them and had left them unprepared for war. So he was a left winger, a peacenik at heart, but he said labor is not taking matters of defense seriously, and the Palestinians are out to kill us. They're not really sincere. I'm going to vote for Bibi despite being a Meretz supporter. So this was all very good news for Bibi to say that I have support across the spectrum. Okay. Well, another thing that Bibi had going for him was Chabad. And Chabad knows how to play the race card. Off the record, I should really put the tape recorder off for a second, but I'm not going to. I'll take a chance here. There is a strong Jewish chauvinist element within Chabad, an anti-Gentile sentiment. It's been around since the days of the Balatanya, and it's around Ad Hayom Hazeh. It's often denied, but you can't really deny it. And their slogan was, Rak Netanyahu Tov La Yehudim. Only Netanyahu is good for the Jews. In Israel, are you allowed to talk about Jews? You're not supposed to. In Israel, it's about Israelis. And who's an Israeli? Anyone who holds a passport. It doesn't matter whether you're a Jew, a Christian, a Muslim, a Druze, a Buddhist. I don't care. You're a citizen. This is a regular state with full rights. Your religious identity is of no consequence. To inject Yehudim into the discussion was basically to say, who wants Peres? The Goyim. And which Goyim in particular? The bloodthirsty Arabs. But the Jews, Netanyahu is good for the Jews. Now, the Chabad introduced this for two reasons. One, on matters of the territories and withdrawal versus retaining the territories, but also on matters of religion and state. The thinking is that labor merits equals the demise of the status quo, and pork and Chilul Shabbos and everything else. But Bibi represents catering to the whims of the religious parties, and Shmiras Shabbos and Kashrus and the rest, and funding the yeshivas. Okay. So,
wouldn't that be just young Israel's opinion too?
It could be, yeah.
I mean, just just because Chabad says it, and the other one.
All right, but they're the ones who were out of the streets pushing this. Peres said that this was a quiet election. There was no political violence, because after all, Rabin had just been killed, and to be violent was taboo. Even to be verbally violent was taboo. I mean, this was a very quiet election, as Israeli elections go, because of what happened on November 4th, 95. The only ones who violated the quiet was Chabad, to have kids in the street with placards and mishigas and the occasional picture of a labor figure with a Hitler mustache or the like. Okay. So, there was a debate. A debate about 3 weeks before the election. A TV televised debate. And everybody admitted, was Modala Emes, that Bibi won this debate, and Peres didn't do well. Why? Peres argued after the fact that there was poor lighting and he didn't have his makeup done properly.
Sounds like Nixon and
Mrs. Nixon and Mrs. Kennedy. Yeah. Okay. So that's what he was complaining about. Well, let's now turn to the religious parties. Because the religious parties do better than ever before. They win 23 seats. Now that's unheard of. Shas won 10, the National Religious Party won 9, and Aguda won 4. This was a fight for the soul of Israel. For the first time in a long time, the religious parties went to the wanted their constituents to go to the polls thinking that the soul of Israel is at stake, that the Labor Party, the left side of the aisle, are destroying the Jewish character of the country, and we need to come home to our true spiritual and political home, whether Shas, the NRP, or Aguda. Okay.
Sounds like 2019.
Not as much, because blue and white was not seen as anti-religious. It really wasn't. Whereas Labor Merits in 96 was seen as un-Jewish. Okay, so, what happened? I'll give you an example. Who was the Minister of Education in the Labor government? At first it was Shulamit Aloni, but they kicked her out because she was too much of a practically a shiksa. So they put in Amnon Rubinstein, also of Merits. And in 1996, he decided that the matriculation exam for high school students is not going to have Bible. It's going to have physics and math and the chemistry and all the others and civics and history, fine. But no Bible. Bible's not important. Now, that's just one little petty example. But I give you this example to show that the Labor Merits Alliance was seen as indifferent to the Judaic heritage. So the NRP runs this with a slogan, Tzionut im Neshama, Zionism with a soul. And everybody admitted that that was the best slogan of the whole campaign, that they were going to win more seats than they had previously because they were running the right kind of campaign, a positive campaign, which is implicitly negative towards everybody else, but on the surface positive, that Zionism with a soul. We represent good spiritual Zionism. And they did very well. They went from 6 seats to 9, a tremendous increase, not to their highest levels ever, but they did much better this time than they had in the 4 previous cycles. Meretz was accused by the various religious parties of representing permissiveness, promiscuity, drunkenness, drug addiction, and the breaking of family ties. In other words, all the liberal values that are the demise of good conservative family values, that's Meretz. And we, the religious parties, especially Shas and the NRP, because Aguda's in a class by itself, we represent good family values, decent, decorous behavior. Okay. Shas has a few tricks up its sleeve. Who's Rabbi Yitzchak Kaduri? Remember him? He died about a decade ago. He was 106 when he died. He was the leading Kabbalist in the Sephardic world. I believe he was Iraqi. And he was giving out amulets, kameot. If you vote for Shas and you get this kameya, it'll protect you. All right, you'll get it's Hatzlacha Rabbah. So people wanted it. Now, a lot of people believe in this stuff. And the left side of the aisle doesn't believe in it, the secularists. But they know as a political matter it's very efficacious. Because for the people who do believe in it, it's a guaranteed vote. So they called the Central Election Commission and said, this is unacceptable. It's bribery. So the Central Election Commission said, no more kameot, you can't give it out. You can give brachot, verbal blessings, but no tangible item. All right, that's what we're dealing with here. Now, the NRP formally endorsed Bibi. They said, you vote for us, and for Prime Minister, you vote for Bibi.
Was that Baba Sally's crowd?
Yeah, it's a similar crowd. So, NRP formally endorsed Bibi. Aguda formally endorsed Bibi. Shas did not. Shas hedged its bets. They knew that most of their voters were going to vote for Bibi, but they played it safe just in case the other side wins, just in case Shimon Peres wins, because they don't want to be out of government and lose the spoils of war. They want to play it safe. The modern Orthodox crowd, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein made a comment. He said that matters of national security and defense should determine your vote for prime minister, but matters of the Jewish character of the state should determine your vote in the Knesset election. In other words, vote for a religious party, notably the NRP. The Haredim were very afraid. Turns out they shouldn't have been afraid, but they were very afraid. Of what? Remember, the Haredim are a cloistered bunch, and they feared that the dual ballot would introduce to their audience secular Jews, secular parties. Their people are going to vote for either a Likudnik or a Labourite for prime minister. In their lives, they never voted for a Likudnik or a Labourite. They voted for Aguda time and time again. And the fear was, well, if they're going to vote for prime minister from a major party, they may also pull the lever for a major party in the Knesset election. They were really worried about this. Very, very worried. As it turned out, they had nothing to worry about. Nobody did that. In fact, the opposite happened. Plenty of people who used to vote for one of the two major parties because they wanted to affect the outcome of the race and determine who forms the government realized, well, I'll do that with my prime ministerial ballot. And as for my Knesset ballot, I'll vote for a boutique party of my choosing, whether it's a religious party, an avowedly secular party, an Arab party, whatever it is that I want, or a Russian party we'll get to in a second. Whatever speaks to me personally, that's who I'll vote for in the Knesset. And I don't have to worry about compromising my choice for prime minister because whoever wins, wins. And it's a guarantee they form the government. Okay. So as a result of this, Shas goes up, NRP goes up, and Yisrael Ba'aliyah goes up. That's a little pun. Yisrael Ba'aliyah goes up. All right. So YBA, let's talk about the Russians. Remember I said last time that in 1992, the Russians tried to form their own party, the Da Party, Demokratia of Aliyah, and it failed? Actually, there were three Russian parties, they all failed. And that most of the Russian vote went to Labor. And Likud was shocked, because they thought they were going to capture the Russian vote. And in fact, it went to Rabin and Labor. Well, what happened now? Yisrael Ba'aliyah won 7 seats! Tremendous number for a party that never previously existed. All right, outpacing many of the other veteran parties. Why did they do so well? Let's find out. A bunch of reasons why. Number one, the direct election. Again, people could vote for a boutique party and decide the prime ministerial outcome on the same day. So Russians who wanted to determine the outcome of the government could do so and still vote for a Russian party. Secondly, disappointment with both major parties. When you're not a veteran Israeli, when you're a newcomer, you'd like for one of the two big parties to cater to your interests and to do well by you. So you'll give them a chance. What happens if they fail? Well, you won't give them another chance. So in 1992, the people who were disgruntled with their absorption because they came in 1989 off the boat, and for the next 3 years they couldn't find work or good housing, they're angry with Likud and they vote for Rabin. Well, in 1996, if they're still without good work and without good housing, they're angry at Labor. But they don't like Likud and they don't like Labor. So what do? Vote Russian, your own party. Okay. Next point is, in the mid-1990s, there was a real cultural problem in Israel of the veteran Israelis not respecting Russian Olim. It was said that everyone's a criminal, that it's all mafia, prostitution, drugs, and domestic violence. Oren Namir, who in the Labour government was Minister of Labour and Welfare, said, and I quote, "One-third are elderly, one-third are criminals, and one-third are welfare cases."
And some aren't even Jews.
Even worse, okay? But the one-third, 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 that's a nasty thing to say. That reminds me of the one-third of the Jews will leave, and one-third of the Jews will be killed, and one-third of the Jews will convert to Russian Orthodoxy. That's what they said in the Tsarist period, okay? People thought that every Russian businessman was a mafioso and every blonde female was a prostitute. It's a real problem that people are offended by the stereotypes about their community. Moreover, the Russian scientific elite was snubbed and rejected by the Israeli establishment. And the major political parties did not understand that not everything was about housing and employment, the tangible things. A lot of it was about the ephemeral, that we want to be respected and not treated with disdain and thought the worst of. The next point is, why did Yisrael Aliyah do well? Because it was an avowedly Zionist party. At a time when post-Zionism is taking off on the left side of the aisle, this was an avowedly Zionist party. A party believes in Kibbutz Galuyot and Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Okay? Which means that some veteran Israelis will be willing to vote for it as something of a protest vote. Next point, for pragmatic reasons, Yisrael Baliyah was centrist on the peace process. Some of their folks were right wing, some of their folks were left wing. Well, if you want to win votes across the spectrum, what do? You say nothing. That doesn't mean I don't have an opinion, but as a party, we're not going to articulate an opinion. And we're not going to favor any one candidate in the prime ministerial race, which means that whoever wins will need us as a centrist party in the formation of a government, which means that Russian politicians will get ministries that are important to them, like the Ministry of Absorption or Immigration or the Ministry of Housing or whatever it might be. We're going to get the spoils of war. Next point. They took a very savvy approach towards matters of religion and state. Okay? They opposed all changes to the law of return. Why? Well, it directly affects them. They want to be able to bring in their relatives who might not be halachically Jewish. So that's a bread and butter issue, no change to the law of return. But they favored civil burial arrangements for people who could not be buried in a Jewish cemetery. And they favored expedited conversions. So these are all things that are in their favor. Expedited conversions, burial arrangements, law of return. But don't attack the rabbis head on. Meaning we don't want to be a Russian version of Meretz, where we're seen as hating religion. No, no, no. We don't hate religion. We need the rabbis. The rabbis have to be our friends because we want them to convert us when we need it. So we want to pick away at the margins in things that benefit our constituency, but we are not calling for civil marriage, and we are not calling for non-Orthodox Judaism. Very important point. 20 years later, all the centrist parties want to see the undermining of the religious status quo and want to see the reform and conservative movements get status in Israel. In 1996, that was not the case. Yisrael Baliyah was not looking to undermine the Orthodox monopoly. They just wanted the Orthodox monopoly to be a little bit more lenient, a little makil, when they needed to be. And several of the candidates were themselves Orthodox, and others were traditional. Yuli Edelstein is an Orthodox Jew. Natan Sharansky, a traditional Jew with an Orthodox wife. All right. So, and lastly, Sharansky was the unifying figure. Extremely popular. He didn't run 4 years earlier. He does run in 96. For all these reasons, Yisrael Baliyah does tremendously well. What was the other centrist party? The Third Way. The Third Way was a breakaway from Labour. They were people who feared that Labour had gone too far to the left and was going to give away the store, and especially was going to give away the Golan Heights. And so Avigdor Kahalani, the hero of the Yom Kippur War, establishes a breakaway party. They win 4 seats. So Aliyah and Third Way combined for 11 seats as centrist parties. That had not happened since when? Since 1977 with the good old DMC and Yigal Yadin. So there's a real center core there that's going to determine who gets to form a coalition. Okay. Well, what about the Arabs? What are the Arabs going to do? Well, they do very well for themselves. They win 9 seats, much more than previously. Why do they do so well? Again, number one, the split ballot. Arabs can vote for Arab parties and still vote for Shimon Peres for prime minister. But there's there are other things in play. One of them is that they have more variety to choose from. What different kinds of Arabs are there in Israel? Okay, they're Druze. What else?
Christian.
What else?
Muslim.
But politically, what are there? There are communists. There are integrationists. There are Palestinian nationalists. And there are Islamic fundamentalists, Islamists. So historically, not all those groups gained representation in the Knesset. Usually they were just the satellite parties of the Mapai who were integrationists, and then the communists. But in 1996, integrationists are Israeli Arabs who don't regard the Palestinian cause as their cause. They just want to have full rights in Israel and have equal access to public services and not to be a second-class citizen. So in this election cycle, all those groups had representation. There were Islamic fundamentalists. There were Palestinian nationalists. There were integrationists, and there were, of course, the communists. But what happens when you have too much variety? One of them, or more of them, might fall below the threshold. So they were smart. Instead of having four parties, there were two lists. One won five seats, one won four seats. So you had all the options in front of you, but you were assured they weren't going to fall below the threshold. And you had direct election of the prime minister. Put it all together, and the Arabs win nine seats instead of five or six or seven. They do very, very well for themselves. Does it matter? Doesn't matter at all. Why? Because no government was going to include them. So it just eats away at the total of 120 Knesset seats. It's like they disappeared. They don't really matter. Okay. Well, one particular incident was pretty ugly in the election cycle, and I'll end with this one. After some of the terrorist attacks in February, March of 96, there was a raid all over the West Bank to try to arrest people who were guilty of being complicit in these terrorist attacks. And a man by the name of Mohammed Abu Warda, was arrested for recruiting bombers on behalf of Hamas. And he was arrested and put in jail. And Israeli television interviewed him in jail. And he claimed that Hamas wanted Likud to win, and that's why they were engaged in bombing campaign during the election season. Peres was caught on a hot mic saying, quote, "I had known this all along, but didn't want to fan the flames." Whoa. So Benny Begin saw this on TV and stormed the TV studio and denounced as cynical this whole episode to blame Likud for terrorism. And he said that Warda's confession was a counterfeit confession. Now what's going on here? There's terrorism against Israel, and it's during an election season, and an arrested man says, well, it's because the terrorists want a certain side of the aisle to win, the side that is less conciliatory, and the side that is more conciliatory says, yeah, we knew that, but we didn't want to say anything. So Peres, whether he was sincere in that comment or not, and I think he probably was sincere, is casting aspersions on Likud as saying, Likud, again, has Jewish blood on its hands, that because of Likud, Jews are dying in the streets.
Why would they want Likud to win?
Okay, so Hamas wants Likud to win because Hamas opposes the peace process. They don't believe that the PLO, as representatives of the Palestinian national movement, should be engaged in a dialogue with Israel and a political accommodation and final settlement with Israel. They believe in fighting a perpetual war and dying to the last man. So they would want a right of center government that is not likely to sign a final deal with the Palestinians. But, and this is an important but, Hamas wants to kill Jews whenever they can. They don't need an election cycle as an excuse to do it. So therefore, this whole discussion is silly. Yes, there's a certain logic to it, but over and above that logic is a certain silliness. They'll kill people whenever they can, not excluding during an election cycle. Okay. Well, a few last little cleanup points. Bibi, when it came to Oslo, had initially opposed it, but just before the election said, we're going to have to accept it. And his words were, quote, "We are like businessmen who take over a business with debts and entanglements." Meaning, if I buy a business that was being run poorly by the previous owner, and he was in debt and he had all sorts of business complications, but I buy the business, now those are my debts and my business entanglements. I have no choice but to address them. I can't just pretend like they don't exist. So therefore, I was against Oslo, but it was signed by a legitimate Israeli government. I will be the next legitimate Israeli government. I have to address the fact that it can't be just ignored or disappeared. You have to do your best to improve upon it. Now, Ariel Sharon, ever the hardliner, said, if Likud accepts Oslo, it has no right to exist. Now, Ariel Sharon said that in 1996. Bear in mind that 9 years later, he pulled out of Gaza. And 10 years later, abandoned the Likud and established Kadima. So nobody follows the same course of political logic their whole career. Well, I mean, some people do, but most don't. Most people evolve over time, and Sharon is talking a tough line in 1996, a line that he would not say 10 years later. Now, another point, Shimon Peres wanted it to seem as though there was a new Middle East, and that Israel is on the cusp of entering the Middle East for the first time. That what is Israel prior to the 1990s? It's a garrison state of Jews that incidentally is geographically located in the Middle East, but it's not part of the Middle East. It's an island unto itself, surrounded by a hostile Arab-Muslim world, which is the true Middle East. And Peres says, no, we're going to have a bright future where it's all a big, big happy region. There was one fly in the ointment. Israel had peace with Egypt. It was an extremely cold peace. Hosni Mubarak did nothing to make that peace any warmer. He allowed for anti-Semitic propaganda to be spread all throughout Egypt in the educational system and on television, like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion type of propaganda. He did not facilitate cultural interaction or person-to-person interaction between Jews and Egyptians, and blocked Egyptian tourists from going to Israel. So this is an extremely cold peace. Well, if relations with Egypt are bad, then how can you say that relations with other Arab entities with which we're now concluding a deal are going to be any better? So Mubarak wasn't doing Peres any favors by being so icy to the state of Israel. There's one other Arab figure who did the most damage to Peres's electoral chances, but it wasn't intended as such, and that is Yasser Arafat himself. Arafat wants Peres to win, because Arafat wants to get more and more and more, and he thinks that Likud won't give it to him, but Labor will. But Arafat basically cost Peres the election, almost, sort of. There are certain people who are entitled to vote in Israeli elections, but who typically don't, and especially didn't in 1996, and Arafat told them not to. And who am I referring to? Arab residents of Jerusalem, especially East Jerusalem. They can vote in Israeli elections if they hold citizenship, but they typically don't hold citizenship, and they typically don't vote. But they could. And in a very tight contest, they could have been the difference, you know, the margin of error. But Arafat said no. Now, why does Arafat say no? Because Arabs in East Jerusalem voting in Israeli elections is a not-so-tacit way of saying this is part of Israel. Whereas what does the PLO want? For that to be the capital of Palestine. So I understand why Arafat had an agenda, but it hurt his preferred candidate. So in the end, this was a very tight contest, and Bibi pulls it out. The rookie defeats the veteran. Will he govern well? And next week we'll have to find out. The answer to that is largely no. Bibi's first term was not regarded as the greatest of successes, which is why he wouldn't win re-election. But next time when we begin, we'll discuss some of his first moves that cause violence in the streets. So stay tuned.